can hear?
You're lucky. Change places with me. I can't.
Oh, boy.
There, relax out here.
Too loud?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fine.
If it's all right with Montpetit, it's all right with everybody else. Well, thank you very much for coming this afternoon. I know that many of you have to get back to conventions. I know that Senator Humphrey has to get over to cut a television tape or something. We're all busy. I'd like to just quickly run through. I really, with a crowd this size, I ought to introduce everybody that's here, because certainly it's a distinguished assemblage, but I'll just kind of run through the head table. Over on my right here is Hank Fisher, who's state chairman of the DFL, who helped put on the, when they finally brought the Jefferson Jackson dinner to St. Paul, we showed them how it could be done. Now, Hank deserves some of the credit for that, of course, for having the wisdom to bring it over here. But it was just a great thing last night, and a great tribute, of course, to Senator Humphrey. But Hank Fisher, state chairman of the DFL. Next to him is our mayor, who we'll get to later on, and of course, Senator Humphrey. And over here on the left is a man who's a very unexpected guest today, but a fellow who's given all of us, I'm sure, great pleasure throughout our lives. I know I just wish my kids could be here today to see him. And that's Maury Amsterdam, who Ron Maddox was good enough to grab from the airport and bring over here, who is going to be appearing at Diamond Jim's for the next interval. Mr. Amsterdam. Next to him is the unofficial or official mayor of Rice Street, Mayor Cohen's campaign chairman, and everybody's friend, Frank Schneider. And we have with us some members of the city council, beginning with the president of the city council. I can't really call her father of the charter change, but the mother of the charter change, Mrs. Ruby Hunt. And let's see now. Moving up the table is Jack Christensen, DFL labor endorsed candidate for city council. And over here is the fellow in the green necktie. He seems like St. Patrick's Day gets clear into April with him. Is Pat Roder. Now, Pat has been on the city council. He was appointed to that job not too long ago, but during that period of time has certainly established an outstanding record. He was just recognized the other day by the VFW for his contributions in the environment and so on, and at least I read that in the paper. And with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Pat Roder, candidate for city council. Now, I think Vic Tedesco left, didn't he? At least he said goodbye. Vic is probably over entertaining a group of senior citizens or something like that, because that's where you usually see him out helping people. I've always said it for years. I think the Italians would inherit the earth if they weren't so good-hearted. And Vic is typical. And over here is Len Levine, who is an incumbent city councilman, candidate for re-election, DFL and labor endorsed, who's noted especially in the area of noise, aircraft noise. So many others here that I can't possibly recognize them all. Like Johnny Bolin, I see is out here, the head of the Metro Council, and Senator Chenoweth, and just so many others. I'm sure I'd leave somebody out if I even got started, and the only fair way to do it is to run around the entire table. So with that, and I did promise you the program would be brief, it says here that my orders are recognize head table, recognize distinguished guests. And then the third item is either the senator or the mayor, and I don't know which. They said to play it by ear. I'll put the mayor on for a very brief period of time. I don't really know what to say about this guy. When he used to perform the function of taking campaign pictures for Joe Carth, we call him famous photographer Lawrence of Israel. At other times, we called him other things, from the landslide going to several other things. But suffice to say that the candidate for reelection, the incumbent mayor of St. Paul, Mayor Larry Cole.
Bob Berglund put it best at one fundraiser that we were at. And he stood up and he said, I'm deeply touched by your being here, but nowhere near as deeply touched as most of you have been. I really enjoyed today. I've only been at 5 meetings. This is my 6th place that I've been since 9 o'clock with George Stemmick here. Probably the greatest thing that can happen to anybody is an opportunity to sit down and just enjoy Hubert Humphrey. I can't think of anything that's far more pleasurable than sitting next to one of the greatest human beings that I've ever had the opportunity to know. And he's full of wit. I have a little black book in my office that I've taken and written down famous sayings on, and Hubert added one for me today. We're talking about Attorney General Saxby, with whom he's very well acquainted and a personal friend. Families know each other. And I asked him if this was his very own. He said, yes, it's South Dakota common sense. And I asked him, well, he told me that Saxby was a very good friend of his. And just listen to this, folks. He was trying to tell me about Saxby and how better could you take and define a person. He says, Saxby's as independent as a hog on ice. You know, I wish I could come up with stuff like that, but I never came from South Dakota. I enjoyed last night. I was deeply touched. I don't know how many of you were there to hear Tom Tipton sing the song that he did, dedicated to Hubert Humphrey. And the most remarkable part, the best part about it is, I guess we know our Hubert for doing things his way. A man who's operated, sure he's had a lot of pressures on him, but every time Hubert Humphrey has voted on an issue, he's never forgotten people. And this is the most beautiful part about him. And Hubert, when I really got to know you, and I'm not ashamed to say fall in love with you as a human being, it was listening to a radio broadcast of the Democratic Convention of 1948. And I can remember the people in my home as you stood up for the black people and all the minority people of the world, really, and said that we should walk from into the pathways of light, enlightenment concerning the rights of all people. I guess I didn't use just the words you did, or as elegant as you have. But it was that time when I started having my great love affair with Hubert Humphrey and decided politics was something that I'd like for myself. Now, I was a small boy, and you were an older man then. But I can tell you that you've given virtually every person in this room the desire to become involved in politics and to make politics be the clean and the wonderful and remarkable thing that it is. So it's with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce to you Hubert Humphrey, our senator.
Thank you, Mayor. Listen, this is an informal gathering. It's been great fun already, Larry. I want to thank you so much for bringing me together with not only yourself and members of the council and candidates that are here, but with other leaders of this beautiful community of the capital city of St. Paul. It's a great honor to be mayor of this city. I remember when I was mayor of Minneapolis, of course, I didn't speak quite that freely about St. Paul. Johnny McDonough was over here then as the mayor of St. Paul. We used to have a lot of fun. I remember one time, you'll have to just take this now in good humor. And the folks up around Breezy Point, Brainerd, up there in Crow Wing County, decided to give John McDonough's daughter, Mayor McDonough's daughter, a horse. And they had the presentation over here in the city square somewhere nearby. and they had the horse there, and the mayor spoke, and they invited me on over. It was sort of like Nixon going to Russia, you know what I mean? Or China or something like that. It was a kind of a major breakthrough. I came over without even guard. The local police were here to take care of me. And those were the days of bitter rivalry. The American Association, you know, baseball teams, the St. Paul, the Minneapolis Millers, the St. Paul Saints, it was really rough. Well, anyway, they had this dedication, and I just couldn't restrain myself, which, of course, has caused me a lot of trouble in my life. And after they'd given this horse, they asked me to get up and speak, and I said, fine, I got up. Of course, they had to tease me, encourage me. I was a modest fellow. I didn't want to really talk. I got up, and I said, well, I'd always heard a great deal about this city, but I never thought I'd see the living proof. And today, however, the mayor of St. Paul has acknowledged that this is a one-horse town. Now, that's way back when I was mayor of Minneapolis. Now I know that it is atomic propelled. It's like the Apollo space capsule. It has another good Democrat, a good DFLer now, as the mayor of the city. And this is the way it ought to be. We've got Al Hofstede now over in Minneapolis, and the mayor of St. Paul, and we've got a few more to pick up around the state, Hank. Got to get to work at that and sort of tie this thing down. Somebody said to me last night, they said, as a reporter, as a matter of fact, said, Senator, don't you feel that what's happened here in the state with these overwhelming Democratic majorities, that there's a possibility that the Republican Party is just sort of on the way out? And don't you think that's bad? Don't you think it'd be better if even some of the folks that have been helpful to you just kind of help the Republicans so we get a little better balance? And I said, well, now, if you're asking me, do I believe in the extinction of the Republican Party? I said, I want to tell you no. I said, the same issue was brought up a couple of years ago in the Senate. And I was making one of my more impassioned partisan speeches down there. And Senator Norris Cotton, conservative Republican, and a very dear personal friend of mine, as a matter of fact, from New Hampshire, got on up and he said, I've listened to the senator from Minnesota. And he said, all I can gather from his speech is that he'd like to see the Republican Party extinguished, out, finished. And I said, no. I said, the senator's absolutely wrong. I said, I am not that kind of a man at all. I believe the Republican Party ought to be preserved, if only for posterity and historical purposes. I said, I'd like to have one live one in the Senate, like the senator from New Hampshire, and another one stuffed over in the Smithsonian Institution. Hank, I don't want to go that far in Minnesota. But in case you run out of stories, sometime you can use that one, you see. I'm going to use this occasion in a way just to pay my respects to Larry and to all of you that are here, to each and every one, my friend Lynn that is here, Ruby, we're very proud of you. You've already made a great name for yourself in city government. Pat Roedler, I was with Pat and sipped all of his good wine and ate his cheese over there. Got that little book that you handed out. Pat has got a tremendous political future. I'm positive of that. Vic Tedesco came in here, he had a head-on collision in his car, and I just gave him some free legal advice since I'm not a lawyer. I just told him what he ought to do, go over and see a doctor immediately, which he's doing. And Jack, I could have sent him Sam's go see a druggist, as a matter of fact. And Jack Christensen, we met here, when I came in, there were two gentlemen going on out, and I saw they had Christensen badges on. I thought, well, like, I'll right away, that hadn't clicked to me yet, you know, that what was going on. But I see that there's an awful lot of votes for him around here. And Hank, I want to once again thank you. I didn't do so personally last night for a beautiful evening in that civic center of St. Paul. You really have, Mayor, a great civic center. This city has improved so immeasurably, the marvelous downtown development and the great developments that are taking place all through the city. And I want to say to every one of you that have a hand in it, and I know as I look around the room here that many of you here are responsible for many of the services, community activities, land acquisition, the welfare programs, Frank Marzatelli here, the city administrator, so to speak. There are many others here. You all got a hand in it. The best politics is performance. That's a fact. I think that really, I think there's been tremendous change taking place in the country in many ways, economically, socially, politically. And the change that's taking place now is people are not looking for charisma. They're not looking for gimmicks. They're not looking for image. They're looking for substance and character. And they're looking for performance and action. That's what they're looking for. And if we don't give it to them, they're really going to be disillusioned, because we've got big majorities now in many of our state capitals as Democrats. We've got a majority down there in the Congress, but we don't have a veto-proof Congress. I've told my colleagues in the Congress, And those that are going to be aspiring to national office, I said the next few 2 years are going to be critical for us, because we're going to win a big majority in the 74 election, congressional elections. It's going to be unbelievable. Just like what happens to Joe Carth over here regularly, it's going to happen around the country. They make huge majorities. And that's going to put better than 2/3 in the House and the Senate of Democrats. I predict that's going to happen. And then, the Republican, who is not going to be Mr. Nixon, who's going to be not only arm's length away from him, but miles away from him, they're all extricating themselves as far as they can. They're putting in sort of a fumigating system in between them. And that Republican's going to point to that Congress and say, now you had 2 years of an overwhelming Democratic majority. What did you do? What did you do? And let me tell you, you can run against Congress. Make no mistake about it. Truman ran against Congress. Nixon tries to, but he's got too much luggage he's got to haul around. makes a good effort at it. And we in the Congress find ourselves the lowest man on the totem pole in popular esteem as an institution. We're below used car salesmen, anybody else you can think of, or whatever else you may be. We're at the bottom. And there's a reason for that, too. Number one reason is that we refuse in the Congress to modernize our apparatus, to modernize the machinery of Congress. And I've been, I'm hung up on it, and I'm going to do something about it, because the way to get something done in Congress is to make a nuisance out of yourself. It's just to be obstinate, persistent, cantankerous, and just be at it day in and day out. And finally, it will yield. But that place is hard to move 535 members into any kind of consensus at all. But a Congress that is poorly organized, poorly equipped with tools and staff, we were talking about it right here. We ought to be monitoring every law that we pass to see how it works, instead of complaining about the fact that the administration doesn't make it work. We ought to have the computers. We ought to have closed-circuit television. We ought to cover the sessions of every committee. It ought to be open to television and radio. We ought to put it on public television so we don't have to depend on networks, because it's the people's business. And we handle $304 billion worth of budget. By God, we ought to have accountability. And people ought to know what we say, not what some newspaper fellow writes about what we say. With all due respect to them, these 22, 3, 4-year-old wonders that come out of the schools of journalism. I want you to know what Humphrey says, not what somebody says I said. I want you to see me in action. I want you to see Joe Carth in action. I want you to see Fritz Mondale. I want you to see us and hear what we say in committee, and on the floor of the Senate, and on the floor of the House, and then we're going to get clean government, good government. They'll be there with their blue shirts on, and I've got my television outfit on today. We'll be there, we'll be sitting there, and we won't be trying to have a session every day either when we ought not to. We'll program it. I've always wondered how we could program two leagues, American League and National League, 140 games, and not have any real conflicts of programming. By God, we can't program 10 committee meetings in Congress without having duplication. Many is the morning I find myself having to go to 3 committee meetings at 10 o'clock in 3 different buildings, all important. Nobody ever checks with anybody else. This is what's wrong. This really is what's the problem. To put it bluntly, since we're amongst friends, it ain't all Nixon's fault. And he's got enough trouble without us adding anything on it. We're in trouble ourselves. And one, here we have been at this energy question, this energy issue, which is going to plague you in the foreseeable future, mark my words. Don't let anybody kid you. I mean, the oil companies, yes. I said Exxon's going to change their slogan from a tiger in your tank to a burglar in your tank. That's what you're going to mean. But they're making unbelievable profits. But after that's all said and done, even if they were stealing half of it, there's still an energy shortage. And it's going to be one. And there's no way we're going to make it any better for at least 3 to 4 years, because God Almighty can't build a refinery in less than 3 years. And with environmental protection added on, it takes 5. And you don't get gasoline until you get refineries, even if you get the crude, even if my Arab friend back here brings it all in. We still do not have a national energy policy. We still do not have a national energy agency. We don't have a Department of Energy and Natural Resources. We just haven't, as we say, bitten the bullet. And the main reason we haven't is because we are not organized to do it. And we've got to do it. And some of us, I had a meeting just before I left here Friday morning with Mike McCormick of the House, who is the chairman of the Energy Subcommittee over there and the Committee on Science and Astronautics. Excellent man, top grade man. We've been in some seminars that were away from the Hill in Congress trying to pull some things together. Can I just quickly say to you, one of the problems that I see about our relationships in the Congress at home and home is the difficulty of communication. It doesn't do you, you know, you hate to come back here and just blow your own horn, even though you like to hear yourself say it. But some of us work very hard, and I'm at the point in my life where I'm quite emancipated. I'm not asking for anything, don't need anything, not at all sure just what I want to do. So I call the shots as I see them. And the real truth is, you just can't communicate. I've been holding hearings, for example, on the world food crisis, which has been here, it's here, my God, it's going to get worse every year. Population outstripping production. Affluence of nations increasing the food intake for higher protein in the diet is just here. We've drawn down our food reserves from 165 million tons of wheat down to 80 million tons, and every year they go down just a little bit more. And you have a 10% crop failure in the United States, and there'll be a world food catastrophe. And we're just depending on God Almighty to save us every year by good weather. We haven't moved all of last year's crop in Minnesota into the terminals. We're going to produce 100 million more bushels, 100 million more bushels of feed grains in Minnesota this year with no more boxcars, no more hopper cars, with fewer lines of railroads. Everybody can't live on the interstate highway system or in town, you know. Nobody's thinking through these things. That's why I want to be in Congress. I have some knowledge about it. I have some experience in it. I don't know by a long shot all the answers, but I think we've got to do something about it. And that's why I find my work both a challenge, at times frustrating, but most of the time quite rewarding. Now, I got to tell you a couple little stories that I think will kind of liven up the meeting here. By the way, I want to compliment the Saints on what they've been doing in hockey. Having been a North Star fan, it's nice to see the Saints do such a good job. Die seven deaths every time any of our teams lose anything. You ought to see me after the Super Bowl. I was in the hospital. God bless Carl Eller. He called me on the telephone and let me know he and Jim Marshall and Alan Page were all together, and they kind of tried to cheer me up. I'm pleased that the Twins won last night in Kansas City. That's at least one that we tucked away. We're in first place. I think we ought to stop the season right now. You know, just a couple, you know, Larry was saying about some of these yarns that we tell. You know, old Sam Rayburn was a great character. Bob Hess and Joe Carth knew him real well. He was a giant in a sense in the house, he was a speaker, but a true character. And old Sam used to, when we were over here at the bar having a drink, you know, I was talking to her. And I go to a lot of receptions, and we all do. And, you know, you always get just a little better after you've been at a reception for a while. Old Sam used to say, and you ought to remember this when you take a drink, there's no reason for any man or woman to be weak and stupid when for two drinks you can get smart and strong. I think that's one of the great lessons a person needs to remember. You may recall that just recently Georges Pompidou, the president of France, passed away. I was asked by a reporter whether or not I knew him, and I did indeed. That's one of the great pleasures of my life. There is hardly a leader in any country today that I have not known personally, whether it's Harold Wilson in Britain, Willy Brandt, or Walter Scheel. By the way, the foreign minister of Germany lived in my home in 1952. When I was a young senator, and when Mrs. Humphrey and I were there just last year, he put on a big dinner for us, Walter Scheel. Willy Brandt I've known for 25 years. I wired Willie when he got elected. I said, how the hell did you do it? I got a bigger percentage of the vote than you did, and I'm home teaching school. And he became Chancellor of the Federal Republic. Same thing is true of Harold Wilson. Well, I've gotten to know a lot of these, Indira Gandhi, Bhutto in Pakistan, Suharto in Indonesia, just different people. It's been a joy. With Georges Pompidou, and remind me to be sure to tell you about the time, in case I forget it, about Harold Wilson in the Windsor Palace. You want to just have a yarn for a minute? Well, anyway, Georges Pompidou, I was there in France in 67 representing our country on some negotiations on the nuclear non-proliferation treaty and a few other things. And God, everybody was up in arms. You know, there were riots all over, not only here, but there were protesters. I've seen more protesters than a dog ever had fleas, I'm telling you. Every place I went for 3 or 4 years, there was a mass of protesters. I've walked through and got more body bruises than a football player on the Vikings or the Dolphins or anybody else. And I remember we put the wreath at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, and it was just fine. There was no trouble at all. protesters stay back. The French police took care of that. The French police are the toughest police in the world. They got those capes on. And at the bottom of the capes, they have little balls of lead. When they want to clean the streets, and out they go. They just cut you down like a sign. It's unbelievable. But they were taking care of all the protesters there as I put the wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier at the Arc de Triomphe. Then we got in the car, and I got in the car with Georges Pompidou, who at that time was premier, de Gaulle was president. And we went on down to the George Washington arch, and that's where the wreath was to be placed at the for the unknown soldier of America. And Georges Pompidou placed the wreath there. My God, they were standing back there, the protesters throwing tomatoes and rocks and cabbages and so on and raising hell, and the French police were just kind of looking around, you know, thinking, well, they were giving me a rough time, and our Secret Service was fit to be tied. But I had an immediate appointment afterwards, after that little ceremony, with Mr. Pompidou. So he had to get into the car, and I had to stall a while so he could get down to his office, and I could come trailing on in a little bit later with the formalities that were supposed to be due to a person in these exchanges. So he got into the same car that we came in. And some of the protesters thought that I had gotten into the car. And when he drove away, they pelted that car with rocks and eggs and tomatoes and cabbages. It was a mess. Well, he got back to the office, and the word is that he called up the chief of police of Paris. And I tell you, some of my dear friends, that within 1 hour, the streets were cleaned. The police had taken the mobs off the street. It was unbelievable. It was merciless. And when I left there the next day, they had police all the way from the hotel to the airport, along with militia. There were no more demonstrations. So somebody said, did you know Mr. Pompidou? And I said, indeed I did. How well I remember. I had another experience in Rome when I was going to the opera. And some young fellow from Milano, or the secretary of the Communist, Young Communist League, was going to pelt me with a little plastic bag of yellow paint. And there was the director of the opera was there, and he was a huge man. And he stood alongside of me, quite a portly fellow, with his tails and white vest on, you know. And we were standing there, and I had the ambassador's little 13-year-old daughter with us. Mrs. Humphrey was not feeling good that evening, so she stayed back at the embassy. And I've always been told by the Secret Service, never stop, move, 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 because if you stop, you're a target. You gotta move all the time when you're in crowds. Just keep moving. But this little girl was late getting out of the car, and I didn't want to just move. So I waited for her out of the car. And the little 13-year-old came out of the car, and here's the master standing there, the opera master, and all at once, whammo! Somebody threw a bucket of paint, one of these little plastic bags, and it hit him right smack bang in the chest. Missed me, thank God, and splattered over on me. Well, when we came on in, there was a lineup of people for about a block in this place. And I was going down shaking hands, and just like everything was just fine, you know, like most likely somebody put a crumb on me. I'm dripping paint as well as he is. And of course, you wonder what to say. And the man was apologizing, the opera director. My only comment was, I said, does this happen to you often? And this guy was going to die. Pretty was wild. We were privileged that evening to listen to the opera, and had Bach as the president, who, by the way, was a good social democrat in Italy. And then we went up, the next day we went on up to Florence, because we wanted to see the beautiful city, and it had been devastated by floods. And American youth in Europe had been really doing a marvelous job, particularly the young people from the University of Cincinnati that were there in large group from the art school. And as we were driving on in, I like folks, and the Secret Service is always putting up the windows and stuff, and hell, I never could wave at anybody, you know, I didn't stand in there like that. So I said, wind it down, these Italian folks are frank. I said, they're nice, friendly folks, you know. So they wound down the window, and we're going on by, and I'm leaning back, and I'm waving all at once, whammo, an ape comes right on through, catches the Consul General from the United States right alongside the head. I think I should tell you that the Prime Minister of Italy was so infuriated over what happened at the opera that he fired the chief of police of the city on the spot in disgrace for permitting it to happen. I interceded with the president and the prime minister to get the fellow reinstated, because it was surely not his fault. The only thing I said was, you ought to teach these boys to shoot straighter. I said, they missed their target. So we saved them a little bit. One or two just other little yarns I want to tell you about. Last night, I know somebody said to me, are you retiring? And, you know, it was sort of a kind of like a wonderful ceremony of retirement. I just want you to know I'm not. That's number one. But I remember full well when Harry Byrd was going to retire from the Senate. A distinguished senator, conservative from Virginia. I was his seatmate when I was majority whip. There was Mike Mansfield, Hubert Humphrey, Harry Byrd. We had the first three seats right down the center row. And I got to know him right well, and I used to kid Harry all the time. I said, why don't we both just take off, Harry? You vote one way on every damn issue, and I vote the same opposite. You know, it's just a cancel out. We just get a continuing pair, and we just go home. You go to your orchard, and I'll go back to Waverly. I said, we're both beyond the payroll. You like to raise apples. I like to go to New Waverly. It'll be the same thing, because it just cancels out the vote, you know? I mean, you vote. We always voted absolutely opposite, practically, on every issue. But we got to be real good friends, despite these votes. And I remember we were coming out of the Gridiron Dinner one night, right after Lyndon Johnson became president with the death of President Kennedy. And the president said to me, Hubert, come here. I got in his limousine. He said, let's go over to the White House. I want to have a nightcap. I want to talk to you. And then he saw Harry Byrd. And he said, Hubert, go get Harry. Tell him to come on, go with us. I went over to see Harry Byrd. And Harry said, no, he was going home. And he's the only man I ever knew that called President Johnson. You never call a president by his first name. He says, you tell Lyndon. He said that I'm going home. And I said, I don't think he's going to like that, Harry. But he said, well, you tell him. He said, it's very late. So I went back, and the president said, hell no. He said, you go get Harry and tell him to get that damn Chevrolet of his, park it downtown here, and I'll take him home. We'll take him home in the limousine. So I went back and gave the message. And Harry said, no, he'll come over, but he'll drive the limousine. He'll drive the Chevy. He had about a 1960 or 1956 Chevrolet. He only had about $50 million, but he had a 56 Chevrolet that he puts around in. No driver, just himself. And so we went on over to the White House. We went in the back entrance on the southwest gate. And my God, Johnson had the lights off long before the energy crisis. And he was conserving electricity. They had all the lights off in the White House all the time. No lights around it at all. Had one little ball banging down like, you know, in one of these cheap hotels, this kind of point out in front of the door out there. Literally just about that bad. Now when you go in there, it looks like they got the Prussian army there, you know. I mean, they're all standing there. They got new uniforms. My God, it really is something. And it's a little too much. But anyway, we came in, I got in, he says, Johnson said to me, President Johnson, you wait down here, because he said it's kind of dark, you wouldn't turn on the lights, you know. He said, you wait down here, we're saving money those days. And he said, you bring Harry up. So I waited, and Harry came, I brought him on up, and he sat him down. Now, here's what the purpose was. We had a tax bill. We wanted to reduce taxes because there was some needs that changed some of the pattern of the economy. And Harry Byrd was against a tax reduction. He was a very fiscally conservative man. And Johnson knew it, and Harry Byrd was chairman of the Finance Committee. So he's going to work him over. This is the difference between presidents. We got Harry up there. The president told me what the scenario was. And he just sort of waited and timed it for the kill, you see. And he said, now we're going to get Harry up here, Hubert, and we've got to get him to at least agree to report out a tax bill, because the chairman can really bottle it up. So we got up there, and the first thing he said, Harry, he said, how about having a good shot of that old Virginia bourbon? And he said, well, Harry said, I think that'd be all right. He said, Hubert, you go in the Kennedy kitchen. Now, the reason he said that is that Harry didn't like the Kennedys. So he was just, Johnson knew all the angles. And when Jack Kennedy was president, he got a little kitchen built off, kind of like a little bar, just a little alcove off the side there where you could go in and make a sandwich and get a bottle of beer and maybe have a scotch and soda and so on. So I went on in there and poured out and come on back to it. He kept reminding him it was the Kennedy kitchen. That was just kind of touch him up and make him look better, and the other fellow look a little worse. And I brought it back out. We talked a little while. Not a thing about taxes, just visiting. And I can still hear Harry Byrd saying, Lyndon this and Lyndon that, and the president not batting an eye. Anybody else, he'd had him thrown out of the White House. And about a half hour later, another, oh, and he said, ah, oh, he said, Harry, you're not doing very well there. He said, Hubert, go get Harry a couple of fingers there, that good Kentucky bourbon back there. So I went back and got him another big shot. The president gave you a wink. It was just like, you know, two cymbals collapsing. When Johnson gave a wink, just like that. I went back and got him another one. And by this time, he's becoming nice and red. He had a little apple-like face, Harry Byrd. And he's just getting, he's in full bloom. He's getting red. And Johnson's watching him like a hawk. And pretty soon, Johnson says, Harry, you got to see your girlfriend. And he said, then he jumped down, tapped on the door and said, Lady Byrd, your boyfriend's out here. Harry Bird's out here, and Harry doesn't wants to go home, but he won't go home till he has a chance to kiss you goodnight. Of course, Lady Bird's already asleep. That doesn't make any difference. We got public business to do, you know. But this dear, wonderful woman, and she is a wonderful woman, got up, put on her dressing robe, came on out, gave Harry Bird a good squeeze and hug, and old Harry just, you know, no pain now. He's just in great shape. And I remember the president saying, he said, "My God," he said, "Harry, whenever I can't find Lady Bird, I know she's one of three men. It's either you or Lawrence Rockefeller or Hubert Humphrey." He said, "I don't dare leave this town." He said, "I can't trust that woman. She's out with one of you fellows." He just all the time tease. And then meantime, he says, "Now let's have a little nightcap with Lady Bird, and then we'll call it quits. So we just get a little one now." And after a while, he just dismisses Lady Bird. She has done her little job, goes back to her room, and he looks right at him, and he said, "Now, Harry, he's got a mellow boy, I'm telling you, something is a marshmallow." He said, "Harry, I got that tax bill over there, and I know, Harry, that you're not for it. I appreciate that, and I respect you. I suppose maybe your advice is what I ought to take, but I'm committed. Walter Heller and Hubert and all these fellows have committed me, you know, to this tax bill. We got to get, he's always blaming, he'd work it out. It's Heller, it would either be somebody else, you know, got me committed to it." And he said, "It's part of Kennedy's program, and I promised that on Kennedy's grave that I would put through all of Kennedy's program." He said, "Now, Harry, I know you're not for it, but," he said, "if you'll just do me one favor, if I just get your commitment tonight, that you'll let it be reported out if there's a majority for it in that committee, and won't hold it up." He said, "I got to get it out soon." Well, by this time, old Harry is just teary-eyed. He's had the message. He's gotten Lady Bird and three shots of bourbon, two full ones and one half. And he says, "Lyndon, I don't believe in it, but for you, I'll do it." And that was good night. He said, "Hubert, take Harry down there and get him in the car." He got him downstairs and put him in the car. I don't know quite yet how he got home. He got him in the car. And he called the president and said, "You come back up here." Just like that. So I came back and he said, "Now, by God, he got that fellow committed." He said, "I want you to check on him every day. I want you to remind him. You sit alongside of him. I want you to remind him every damn day what he promised the president. Every day, you check back with me." Every day I'd say, "Harry, how are we coming with the tax bill?" "Oh, fine." I said, "The president's so worried about it, Harry. I hope you're going to." "Oh, yes, yes." So by God, finally, about 10 days later, the tax bill's reported out, and Harry comes in there. And some of those that in Washington used to know him so well, he came in there with little glasses on. He stood there, and he just had his little notes. He said to me, "I'm reporting out the tax bill. Will you let the president know?" So I went to, I said, "Harry, fine." He said, "I'm just going to make a speech and I'm leaving." So he came and made about a 10-minute speech on the tax bill, put it in the record. You couldn't hear a word because he'd always kind of just mutter. We didn't have loud speakers or anything in the Senate at that time. And he just put it in the record. And I went, and he said, "You call Lyndon." He was so pleased. And so I went back and called the president. I came back. I said, "Oh, the president is so happy." He said, "That's fine." He said, "I think I'll go home now." That's the way you get legislation passed in the Congress of the United States. I said about retirement, and on this note, I'll retire. This man was going to retire from office, Harry Bird. Bob Kerr wanted to be chairman of the Finance Committee more than anybody ever wanted to be anything in his life. Bob Kerr from Oklahoma, huge, big man. And they had a series of parties for Harry Bird, lionizing him all over the whole seaboard. The Bankers Association, you know, and the Congress had a party for him, the president had a party for him, and Bob Kerr had a party for him. Could hardly wait to get him out, you know, just because that made him chairman. Maybe Kerr was the ranking member, he became the chairman. And so they went down to Richmond, which was the capital city of Virginia, and they had a huge dinner, about like we had last night. And they had Harry there, and they gave him one speaker after another. It was pretty much along our type of program. And then it became Bob Kerr's chance to talk. And Bob Kerr was one of the greatest orators that Congress has ever known. And he got on up there and he made a speech about Harry Bird, the likes of which has never been made before or since. And he praised Bird and he said, "The country will never be the same without him. I don't know what we're going to do in the Congress without this great man. I can't imagine what will happen with fiscal policy of this great country. What will happen to the American dollar? What will happen to the taxpayer of this country?" And he just poured it on. And he sat down, and when he got up, old Harry was just crying. He was just absolutely moved, worse than Humphrey ever was moved. He just was just weeping. He got up and Harry's speech was, "Well," he said, I've listened tonight to this great message, and I must say that after hearing Bob Kerr, I can't resign. I shall continue. Well, Hank, I came home last night. I kind of had some thoughts, and
is a program.
It's called a re-elect Ireland.
Yeah, well.
Is that a word from Phil?
Yes, you know, that, we didn't have that on the agenda, but if we, if you all got time to hear from Mr. Amsterdam, would you be willing?
Yeah, sure.
I gotta tell you, I really enjoyed that. I really, you're a beautiful speaker. Well, Jared, the governor announced that he may try again. I think he got about as much chance as Juan Corona has of being head of the PTA. You know, Juan Corona is the fellow who got in California.
Yeah, thank you.
Northern planter. He not only killed 25 people, he buried them personally. I think that's friendship. He was sentenced last week, by the way, to 100 years on every count, 2,500 years. Next Tuesday, he comes up for parole. We got a wonderful country, but we got the rottenest judicial system in the whole world. This is the only country where they let the prisoner out on bail and lock up the jury. I just would like to say, Senator, if you ever do retire... If you ever do retire, I hope it's someplace not too far from your work. I must tell you a true story about that. I've been a writer all my life. When I was 15, I was writing for a fella named Will Rogers, who you probably remember. Wonderful man, and through the years I've written for Benchley, Hope, just about everybody in show business. And my wife knows that I will not write for anybody unless I've seen what they do, because I think material should be tailored, you know, like a suit. And one day when we were filming the Dick Van Dyke Show, Mr. Johnson was president, and the stagehand comes over. He says, the president wants to talk to you. I said, from what synagogue? He says, no, the president of the United States is on the phone. So I get on, so Mr. Amsterdam, yes, just a moment. President Johnson wants to speak to you. So the president comes on, whom I had only met once because Jack Kennedy was a good friend of mine, and I had met him through him. And he said, I am being made an honorary member of the Washington, D.C. Press Club, and I wish that you would, he said, I'm taking the liberty of sending under diplomatic pouch, he says, my speech. He says, I'd like you to pep it up for me a little bit. So I got home, I said to my wife, how do you like that? The president wants me to write some jokes for him. She says, tell him you don't write for him till you see him work. But it's been a joy to meet you and to hear you, and bless you and be well.
Thank you much. Thank you. I'll be writing you.